Gideon read from Matthew 27. If you think of the Easter story, there's probably kind of familiar pieces of the plot line. Today is Palm Sunday. We're not specifically focusing on Palm Sunday. We did that actually a few weeks ago. We've been working our way through the Gospel of Matthew. It's lined up pretty well that we've been working through Easter through these weeks. In my mind, though, as I think of the Easter story, the Palm Sunday, we've kind of got from, you know, Jesus who enters Jerusalem and the people start to cheer and there's excitement around this idea of him being the one who will save them. It goes from that to him starting to speak of his death, particularly around the Last Supper. And then he is in the garden and he's praying and asking God to intervene. But again, comes back to that point of saying, but not my will, but yours be done. He's going to go to the cross. He's going to save us. Then there's a trial. He's put on trial. It's a mock trial. The whole thing is just a massive injustice that then brings us to the actual moment of crucifixion. He's buried. And then we get to the end of the story, which is next week. He rises from the dead. And that's Easter. What's interesting about that is if you think of kind of the plot line in that way, the passage we come to this morning doesn't really touch on any of those things exactly. And yet Matthew will spend more time talking about the things he will from verse 51 to 66 than he actually will talking about Christ's death on the cross itself, which kind of begs the question of why we don't slow down a little bit more often in these verses to think of what it is that Matthew wants us to see. And that's our goal this morning. We're going to work from verse 51 all the way to 66. And just kind of the outline, because there actually is one this morning. I don't often have points. There's five. This is going to be really easy to remember. There are five responses, really, to the crucifixion. First is going to be the response of God himself through a number of supernatural events occurring around the death of Christ. Then we're going to see how a centurion and some other guards respond, how the women who have been following Jesus respond, how a unique man named Joseph of Arimathea responds, and lastly, how the leadership of the Jewish people responds. So five responses coming from these verses, seemingly to Matthew very important, even though to us, perhaps we haven't meditated on it long enough. And I would just say one last thing. I actually said in the early service that I read, in case you don't know, I read and preach from a version of the Bible in English called the English Standard Version, ESV for short. There are lots of great versions. I know you, many of you read from different ones, totally fine. The reason I love the ESV is because of the word behold. I love behold. Years ago, I used to read and preach out of the NIV. Many of you still do. The NIV doesn't have it. They just dropped it. And I understand why. It's like hark. It's like no one speaks like that anymore. No one says, hey, behold. We might say, look, or look over there, pay attention to. And that's what the word means. It is an imperative, meaning it's a command. But it's one of those commands that's kind of almost more of an exclamation. Like there's some joy around it. It's like, look at this thing. It's really important. Pay attention. Don't miss this. Verse 51, Matthew says, and behold. What is fascinating to me is he doesn't say, don't miss Jesus on the cross, although certainly don't miss Jesus on the cross. But what he's going to do over these next verses is say something along these lines. There are five critically important things I want to tell you. Don't miss them. You're likely to go from the crucifixion and want to jump over to the resurrection of Jesus. But between those two things come five monumentally important things. Do not miss these things. If you're anything like me and you travel and there's those, have you ever seen those signs like point of interest? Or sometimes it's just a symbol. It's like a camera or binoculars. It's like a photo moment. I'm so thankful for those because I'm the guy who's like, I just want to get someplace. I don't necessarily think to be looking at those things. So there's like a sign, it's like a photo moment. You go to the sign, and you're like, what am I supposed to see? Matthew is going to help us a ton because he says, I want you to see some things. Number one is this. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks were split, the tombs were open. Many of the bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. It's like, what on earth is happening? Jesus has died. He will rise. But in the middle of all that come a series of spectacular supernatural events. This is why I kind of think of this as God's response. Because no one else could do this stuff. This is not just natural phenomenon. I was like, wow, what strange timing, an earthquake happened. No, this is the God of all things controlling his creation so that we see some stuff. Now, last week we did look at this already a little bit, so I'm going to move quick through this. Last week I gave you the Old Testament passages that are kind of the framework around why this stuff matters. So real quick, the list would be Isaiah 26 and 65, Ezekiel 37, Daniel 12, and I feel like there's one more. Which was the other one? Zechariah 14. All right, with that in mind, let me explain what's going on here. The Jewish people, again, this is from last week, so review still. The Jewish people read through the Old Testament, and you can too, and you would come across a little phrase. You would come across it many times. And it's the phrase or the title of the moment in history when God would step in a dramatic and massive way to change everything. They simply called it that day. Not a very creative title, but it's like, but you read through the prophets and they will say things like, on that day, oh, watch out. Or when is that day? It's like, that's what they're pointing to. They're pointing to this moment in time when God was going to do something spectacular. Now, they had three things they were looking for in particular. Again, this is from those passages and the prophets of the Old Testament. You go and you read, you'll see why they were thinking this way. Number one, on that day, God would deal with wrong. There is clearly evil and brokenness in the world. And on that day, God would say, enough. Number two, on that day, God would do something so dramatic that it would be spoken of as an act of new creation. Almost like Genesis over again. In Genesis 1 and 2, God creates everything. And on that day, it would be like a whole new creative work of God. Number three, on that day, the dead would rise. There would be a resurrection. It would be a dramatic moment where God clearly was intervening in human history. Now, the Jewish people had essentially like a three-list checklist. They would know that day had arrived when they saw those three things happen. In these few verses, I would suggest to you, it's like a checklist. Beginning actually a little bit back in verse 45, now, the sixth hour, there was darkness over the land until the ninth hour. Presumably at the ninth hour, the darkness ends and light comes out. And whenever you read in scripture about darkness and light, if you've been around church, been around the Bible for a while, probably there is something that comes to mind. It is creation, because there was darkness and God said, let there be light. And all through scripture, when you read darkness and light, it's kind of like a little clue that we're talking about sort of a creation kind of moment or a new creation kind of moment. So Joel 2, Peter's going to pick up from that in Acts as he starts to preach, and he's talking about darkness and light. And the whole point of it is when you read that, God is at work. What was the second of the criteria? One was God was going to deal with evil. Number two, there would be something akin to new creation. You see how the checklist starts to unfold. In fact, if you jump down past the curtains being torn, the earth shook and the rocks were split, this is like Zechariah 14 language. This is, again, kind of one of these moments of like new creation, like the earth itself is shaking and something new is happening. Check number one off our list of three items. Now, we need still two more. The first one, I would say, this whole moment of judgment is actually what verse 51 is about. Now, this moment is a pretty spectacular one. The temple curtain is massive. There's actually two curtains in the temple. There's one between the Holy of Holies and the rest of the temple, which is probably the one we're more familiar with. And then there's one outside that people could actually see between the Jewish and Gentile courts. Both huge. We don't know which one, in all honesty, is being torn. They both make sense. In fact, you go through the rest of the New Testament and you could make a case that different passages look back at this and almost point to both. So Ephesians chapter 2 could easily point to the curtain between the Jewish and Gentile areas of the temple being torn, because what happens when Jesus comes and he saves us? He takes two peoples and brings them together in one. There is no longer ethnic division. There's no longer division within the kingdom of God by, you know, economic status or educational status or any of those things. At the foot of the cross in Christ, we are one. And so you can kind of picture, if that's the curtain that gets torn, it's like, that's pretty fitting, because that's what Christ's death accomplishes. But Hebrews 4 actually brings us to a different point. Hebrews 4 would point more to that inner curtain, the big one. Each braid had 24 threads. Each one of those threads of 24 threads took 72 of them to start weaving the curtain. By the time they were done, 300 men to carry this sucker. It was actually 4 inches. It was the width of a man's hand thick. Now, I don't have the biggest hands, but between 4 and 6 inches thick, 60 feet tall, 30 feet wide. And you read the description. Behold, the curtain was torn in two from top to the bottom. It's like God, it's almost like, I was in high school, there was this weird thing called the power team. This is, I'm showing my age. So this is like early 90s. It was this group of Christian strongmen, and they traveled around the nation telling about Jesus, and they did incredible feats of strength. Anyone ever see this? A couple of us. Awesome. It was pretty awesome. All right, so truth be told, so I go see this thing, and then I come home, and it's like, surely I can do some of this stuff. Turns out I can't. I cannot take a phone book and tear it with my hands. It's almost like God reaches down from heaven, just rips that thing apart. Can't be done humanly. That's the whole point of building a curtain so massively strong. And you can imagine the implications of what would it mean, therefore, if the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies, in other words, the place that symbolically God dwelt, God dwells everywhere, but in a special way in the minds of the nation of Israel, that's where God lived. And if you wanted to get as close to God as you could come as close to that as you humanly could. But only one priest once a year was allowed to actually enter in, right? And they actually tied a string. You've probably heard these stories. They actually tied a rope around his leg in case somehow when he went in, he was unclean and he just dropped dead and they could drag him back out. Like, that's the seriousness of this situation, this place. There's actually a very interesting historical footnote from 63 BC when the Roman general Pompey went into Jerusalem, captured it, desecrated the city. It is said, hinted at least in historical documents, that he actually looked inside the Holy of Holies and it was empty. In other words, what had happened when the temple was destroyed had never been fully restored, and the Jewish people, the high priests, had just kept an illusion going that somehow God was present. And when all of a sudden that get ripped apart, everyone can see the spoof is up. God literally had left the building. Now, that's a little bit, we're speculating a little bit. But you can understand the symbolism of if God's there and the temple's or the curtain is torn, now we have access to him. And that's the point that Hebrews chapter 4 is making. You don't need to go to a temple. That's why you don't need to come to me if you want to talk to God. You don't need to go to one of our elders if you want to talk to God. Anytime, any place, anyone, you can speak to God. Because Jesus is our new high priest. That's an incredible thing. It's amazing how easy it is to not take advantage of that, though, isn't it? And to forget that we have access to God anytime and to forget how precious that is. Temple torn, or curtain torn, though, if we were to understand biblically, this is a sign of judgment. It's actually what that is, that God is judging. Go back to the Old Testament, whenever there was a moment where the temple was in jeopardy, that's the language that comes. Check number 2 off our list of 3 things. God's going to judge, deal with what's wrong. God's going to bring a moment of new creation. What's number 3? Dead people have to come back to life. You see why Matthew is writing the way he is? Because the next thing he's going to tell us, tombs were opened. And you can read it just as well as I. You'll actually realize what Matthew has done is actually told us the story slightly out of chronological order to put this note of people being raised from the dead right here. It actually happens after Jesus rises from the dead. Jesus rises and others rise. But Matthew arranges it so that as we're reading through it, we'd go tick, tick, tick. What does this mean? On that day, something spectacular is happening. Now, I likened it, I think, a couple months ago to like the analogy of D-Day and V-Day in the war, right? D-Day, a monumental victory in the war. The tide was turned. It was just a matter of time, essentially. But there was still lots of loss of life. There was still lots of struggle before victory. I think that's a pretty fitting way to think of what Christ accomplishes on the cross, that when he dies for sin, it's like the strategic decisive blow is struck. And one day he's going to return and victory will be clear. And we live between the two. And Matthew is saying, here's the response of God. Don't miss it. Something in human history spectacular is happening right here. That's response number one. Oh, and isn't it cool? Jerusalem is still the holy city, not because of anything to do with themselves, but because of God. Notice that little note. They went into the holy city because you would think, surely at this point, all hope is gone. No, never gone, not when God's in the picture. Response number two, verse 54. When the centurions and those who were with him, meaning the other Roman soldiers, because the centurion is in charge of 100 soldiers. So the centurion and those with him, keeping watch over Jesus. In other words, this is the group of soldiers who have been at the cross, making sure Jesus doesn't get down. No one comes and tries to save him. We make sure we get him good and dead. The same group was there earlier in chapter 26, around verse 27, because they were involved in the trial of Jesus. And you remember last week, we looked at this moment where they bring him into the praetorium. There's 600 of them at this point, and they do a mock coronation. They take Jesus. It's like, you think you're king? This will be great. We'll give you a robe. Here, put this on. We'll give you a crown. Here, try on these thorns. You want a scepter? Here, hold this. No, actually don't. We'll take it back and we'll beat you with it. And the Roman soldiers who do that have gathered for that purpose to mock him, make sure he was sentenced to death, and then a few of them were assigned the task to make sure he was dead. They watched the whole thing, and here's what we find out. They saw the earthquake and what took place, and they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. The first converts to Jesus are the most unlikely group of men on the planet. Truly, this is the Son of God. Like, I'm struck by a couple things in this. I'm struck by the fact that they will throw their lot in with Jesus after he's dead. Isn't that amazing? They don't wait for the 2 days as probably I would have been inclined. It's like, at this point, it looks like Jesus is a failed insurrectionist. He is sort of led in the minds of the Romans. He's led a failed rebellion. He is a failed Messiah. He is a king who is dead. And this is the moment the Roman centurions go, him right there. He's the true Son of God. This is a massive statement. Again, multiple reasons. In Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, you go back to chapter 1. This has been what Matthew is preparing us for the whole way through the book. He says, I'm going to tell you the story, the genesis of Jesus, the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. By the time he's done chapter 1, he's told us, and he is God who has come to dwell with us. And then the story begins, right? And we're waiting for the moment. Like, when will the moment be in this grand, amazing story where we finally hit the pinnacle where someone goes, he's God. And who will it be? Will it be a disciple? Will it be like God from heaven? God's spoken into this. And then we arrive at this moment, and here it is, a Roman centurion at the point of his death. He's the Son of God. Now, in the Roman world, there is a Son of God. His name is the Emperor. It's not unlike a lot of other civilizations who their lead, whoever the king or the emperor or the pharaoh or whatever that position is, they would view it through the religious lenses of he is divine. So yeah, he's not God. He's usually viewed as the Son of God. It is a way to affirm his supreme power over everyone in the kingdom. The Emperor of Rome had that language. Can you imagine now for a second, put yourself in the shoes of a centurion who's just watched all this. You have pledged yourself in absolute obedience to the man who is emperor at the penalty of death. He is, in your mind, your eyes, your loyalty, the Son of God. And now you stand at the foot of a dead man on a cross and say, he's the Son of God. That is a spectacular response. And I wonder to myself, what would it have been like to watch the death of Christ? To have stood there, to have listened, to have watched and experienced it, because it was enough for this group of men to say, we got it wrong. Caesar is not it. He is. The third group, a group of women, verse 55. looking on from a distance, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. She's unnamed. It's kind of interesting, the last woman there. Let me start with her. We're not going to look at all because we don't have time, but just real quick, think of this last one for a second. She's been there quite frequently in the story because just a few pages ago, she had come to Jesus and she said, when you enter into your glory, when you sit on your throne, could my boys have the right and left-hand seats? Remember that moment? And Jesus said to her, oh, you don't know what you're asking. You don't have a clue what you're asking at this moment. And there she is at the cross, watching Jesus die, with a criminal on the right and a criminal on the left. And I cannot help but think in that moment, what must have been going through her head is, I had just asked for my sons to take those spots. Have you ever asked God for something and you are convinced you knew exactly what he ought to do? I said to the other service, I've prayed many times over the last couple of weeks for the weather for Easter. It's like, Lord, would you just make it shine and sunny? Oh, by the way, did you know on that day, Old Testament prophecy, one of my favorite ones, I can't give you the, it's in Zechariah. We'll get there in the fall when we do Zechariah. There's no more cold and no more frost. I'm like, wow. Ah, that day is coming. It's going to be good. But I've been praying about Easter weather. You know, I've just realized that in the last couple days as I've been thinking about this passage, I need to make sure that I also, in my prayer, say, Lord, it would be so good if it was sunny or even just not raining. Sometimes I negotiate with God. It's like, I'll take 14 and cloudy if we have to. But God, if your will was different, we would want that. If your will is a torrential downpour and we're here, God, you know far better. Now, that's a silly example. It's real. I've been praying that way. But if you're anything like me, you probably come to God and say, God, here's what I want you to do. I know what you should do. Please do it. And then something different happens. You're like, God, why have you failed? Put yourself in the spot of this woman for a moment. Jesus, here's what I want you to do. Why don't you do it? Yes, we're in. And he says, no. Sometimes the Lord's going to say no. And his answer is going to be such a precious gift to you. Don't doubt him. Trust him. Now, the tricky thing of the woman in this point is that there's sort of almost, there's two ways to read this little bit. And I am guessing you're like me. You read it the one way and don't necessarily think the other way. The way I tend to read it is like, these gals are heroes. And I think they are. Like, well, so many have abandoned, they show up. When Jesus' tomb is there, they're the ones who are going to come in chapter 28. They're the ones who are going to find it empty. That takes guts. Guts that hopefully all of us would have. However, let me just bring a slightly different perspective so that we're reading it probably the way that someone would have read it when Matthew first wrote it. Jesus really is at the lowest of lows because all that's left is a group of women. That's it. And they won't even get close. Notice they're at a distance. That's first century lenses, right? Relook and it's like, they're there, but they're there. Where are the guys? Now, we do know from John's gospel that actually at least one of the disciples is at the cross, but Matthew is just, he just strips all that away. And I think the point is, look at how sad this scene is for Jesus. There's no one left but women. Now, the reason I say that is because in the first century, women, they were considered very much a lower class person. Right? And so if you're saying, hey, look, there's women here, but they're not even close, this is not a good thing. This is a negative thing. And so we arrive at this moment where we're really being told by Matthew, it's like Jesus has arrived in many ways at the lowest of low moments right here. He's dead. There's no one left. The only one to put up his hand and say, I'll follow is a Roman centurion. But this group of women just keep doggedly hanging in there. And that is awesome. Their response? They won't abandon him. Fourth response, and we'll move real quick through this next little bit here, because it's actually, this is my favorite one. Joseph of Arimathea. Who is he? Where did he come from? And why does he all of a sudden show up here? Each of the Gospels, so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all had a different detail. So if you were to want to know about Joseph, you actually have to read each of the four Gospel accounts, because they're all going to focus on one different part. Matthew focuses on the fact he's a rich man. Perhaps because Matthew was a tax collector, maybe he could kind of pick up on some of these kind of things. It's interesting, if you think through Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, we've actually just run into this very language not long ago. Remember Jesus saying something about rich men, camels, and needles? It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. That was what he's talking about. So hard, it would be like trying to get a camel through the eye of a needle. And now what happens? When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. Jesus was the one who just a few chapters ago said, with man it's impossible, but with God all things are possible. Some of you have been praying for people for years, for decades. And sometimes it becomes hard to keep praying. It's like, Lord, would you please work in someone's life? My kid, my grandparent, my spouse, my parent. Whenever you get weary, just remind yourself, here was a guy who had everything to lose. Again, you have to kind of get the full picture in the different Gospels. He is a member of the Sanhedrin. Very important man. There's 71 people in the Sanhedrin. It takes 23 to be a quorum. Likely it means he wasn't there at the trial of Jesus. He is a secret disciple, we're told, by one of the other Gospel writers. In other words, he has seen something in Jesus. He's seen enough to know. It's like, I wish I could follow him, but there's way too much at stake. He's a very wealthy man, but not only wealthy, he is respected, or actually the better way of translating the word is he is graceful or gracious. Because there is wealth and power and ugly, and probably you run into that. But this was not that. This was a man who had power. He was in the upper realms. He was like, this is like the equivalent of like the Supreme Court or Senate of the nation of Israel. And he's wealthy and he handles it well. If you got money, you got position, be that. It's not wrong. Just make sure that as you do it, you handle it with grace, with uprightness. That's the third thing we're told by one of the other Gospel writers, is he is a upright man. In other words, he knows right and he knows wrong, and he's been choosing to do what's right. But he's kept his belief about Jesus hidden. If that was you, what moment would you choose to go public? This would not be it if it was me. Jesus is dead. What is there to gain now at this point from saying, I am a disciple? Again, maybe in 2 days, maybe 2 days before you know, the arrests and trials, maybe at the triumphal entry, you're like, hey, I'm going to throw my lot in with him. But here, right now, and not only does he throw his lot in, think of what he does. He actually takes his family tomb. So tombs in the ancient world are different than ours. If you go to a graveyard, we dig holes in the ground. We put the coffins in the ground. The ancient world, the way it worked is typically it was like a cave, at least for the upper class, the wealthier people. You'd have a cave, so a hole into a side of a little rock face. You would have an area within it where the body would be laid and another area within it where the bones would be kept. And the way it worked is you would put your loved one in there gradually. Sorry, this is kind of a little bit gross. There's usually more kids in the first service, so I try to keep it a little bit more kid-friendly. But all bets are off. Plug your ears if you don't like gross stuff. The flesh would decay and rot off the bones. And then you would take the clean bones and you would just pile them at the other part of the grave. And gradually, generation upon generation, your family's bones would be there. That's how they did it. So your bones would go with the bones of your family. Joseph of Arimathea has just built a new tomb. It's not just for him. It's for his family. It'll be for generations of his family. And you think of his first act with it. He takes it and he says, I'm going to put Jesus there. He doesn't know Jesus is going to rise from the dead. But he is prepared to have the bones of Jesus and the bones of his family intermingled. Jesus, who at this point we think of as, through the lenses of the Romans and the Jews, a failed insurrectionist, a failed king, and a failed Messiah. And Joseph says, but he's my failed king, my failed. Not really, right? He has a belief in who Jesus is, enough that it will motivate him to take this dramatic step. But I think the most important piece of all in this whole story is that we're told where he's from. It's like, Arimathea, where is that? 22 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Like, who cares? You do. You want to know why? Because there's another man from Arimathea. His name was Samuel. And you know what his role was really for the nation? It was to anoint the very first king. He was the one who would anoint David. And remember what Matthew told us at the very beginning of his gospel? He wants to introduce you to Jesus. Who is who? The Christ, son of David. And who shows up? A man from Arimathea. And what will he do? He will anoint the body of Jesus for burial. And he will help us understand Jesus is not a failed king. Oh, far, far from it. We are 2 days away from his resurrection. The last group is the Jewish people, the Jewish leaders. And all they can think of is, must cover this up. We don't want anyone to ever think Jesus' claims that he could rise from the dead could ever be believed. They will do everything they can to stop it. They will go to Pilate. They will petition Pilate on one of the most holy days of the year. This is the part we don't maybe think of. They're going to enter into the presence of a Gentile, making them unclean on the Sabbath. Paying attention to the days. We're at the Passover. They've now made themselves unclean by entering the presence of Pilate. They now can't celebrate the Sabbath, and they've now basically put them off limits for being able to celebrate the Passover. So intent they are of stopping this, that they will make themselves unclean for this whole event. And I love Pilate's response. They come, they want a guard, they want this thing sealed up really well. Don't you love Pilate's response in verse 65? You have guard, like take soldiers, seal it up. That's a whole nother neat process of how they did that in the Roman world. Make it as secure as you can. I don't know what exactly Pilate meant, but don't you just love that? It's almost like, good luck. If he is who he claims to be, you're not stopping this. There's only one response left, and that's ours. We've got God's, centurions, the women, Joseph, the Jewish leaders. How do you respond? If Jesus really is who he claims to be, if he is the Christ, the son of David, the son of God, who has given himself for us that we could be forgiven, is not the only right response in the world to trust him and to love him and to thank him. That's what Easter is all about. That's what makes it such a great time to be able to celebrate. Because as we celebrate, we can thank our Savior and Lord, the King of Kings,